Welcome to the No Illusions podcast, recorded March 8th, 2011. This is No Illusions, the news you need to know. My name is Cameron Riley. You're listening to the Podcast Network. First up this week, we look at what's been happening with Bradley Manning in the US. He's been hit with some new charges, including the most serious of aiding the enemy. 22 additional charges have been filed against Manning by the US Army. And this serious one, aiding the enemy, is an offence that carries a potential death sentence. Other charges include wrongfully causing intelligence to be published on the internet, knowing that it will be accessed by the enemy, and violating Army regulations on information security. In a blog posting, Manning's attorney David Coombs wrote that the charges come at a recommendation of Manning's commander, and it's unclear whether he'll actually face all of them. Coombs wrote, "The decision to prefer charges is an individual one by PFC Manning's commander. The nature of the charges and the number of specifications under each reflects his determination, in consultation with his staff judge advocate's office, of the possible offences in this case. Ultimately, the Article 32 investigating officer will determine which, if any, of these additional charges and specifications should be referred to a court-martial." In other Bradley Manning news, there are reports that Manning, who's been held in solitary confinement for more than 7 months at a marine brig in Quantico, has been confined to a 6x12-foot cell for 23 hours each day, constantly watched on video cameras, denied physical exercise and articles of clothing and bedding, denied sleep during the day, and repeatedly woken by guards throughout the night. Just 24 hours after being informed that he now faces a potential death sentence, Manning was reportedly forced to strip in his cell and was then left naked for more than 7 hours overnight. When it came time for his morning inspection at 5 a.m., Manning was forced to stand naked outside of his cell and submit to inspection. He's had to undergo this same humiliation every day since. According to his lawyer, David Coombs, a Marine spokesperson said, "The decision to strip him naked every night is for PFC Manning's own protection." They stated that it would be inappropriate to explain what prompted these actions. Incredible level of hypocrisy coming out of the United States in their treatment of Manning. This is a guy who hasn't been tried yet and is being tortured. You know, we saw all of the concerns that came out of the torture of prisoners at Abu Ghraib and also Guantanamo Bay. You know, people being held for years on end without a trial, in many cases without even knowing what the charges were that were being levied against them. And obviously extreme torture tactics, and these same sorts of psychological and emotional torture tactics are now being applied to a United States citizen who hasn't been found guilty and, you know, hasn't even been given a fair trial yet, and who should be protected under whistleblower protections for the extreme acts of the US military that he revealed through the documents that he allegedly released to WikiLeaks. Salon.com's Glenn Greenwald wrote, "The treatment of Manning is now so repulsive that it even lies beyond what at least some of the most devoted Obama admirers are willing to defend. For instance, UCLA professor Mark Kleiman, who last year hailed Barack Obama as, and I quote, the greatest moral leader of our lifetime, wrote, 'The United States Army is so concerned about Bradley Manning's health that it is subjecting him to a regime designed to drive him insane. This is a total disgrace. It shouldn't be happening in this country. You can't be unaware of this, Mr. President. Silence gives consent.'" Of course, to the best of my knowledge, Obama hasn't made any comment about Manning's treatment. Greenwald added, "Just fathom the contrived, shrieking uproar from opportunistic Democratic politicians and their loyalists if it had been George Bush and Dick Cheney on US soil subjecting a whistleblowing member of the US military to these repressive conditions without being convicted of anything, charging him with a capital offense that statutorily carries the death penalty, and then forcing him to remain nude every night and stand naked for inspection outside his cell. Feigning concern over detainee abuse for partisan gain is only slightly less repellent than the treatment to which Manning is being subjected." Now, this is obviously happening under the Obama administration. And, you know, it's just amazing that there's nowhere near the sort of outcry from the Democratic side of politics that you would, as Greenwald says, you would have expected under a Republican White House. And it also just goes to show the absolute hypocrisy, I think, of the Obama administration, which, you know, campaigned on a fairer America and an America getting back to its roots of individual rights and democracy, and which has done everything in its power since taking the White House to push the limits of what they were going to put American people through further and further. In other American news, I don't know if you've been following the story of Tim DeChristopher. Tim DeChristopher is an economics student in Salt Lake City, Utah. And in December 2008, he showed up at a Bush administration's oil and gas leasing auction in Salt Lake City. And he stood outside with the other protesters and thought they were fighting a losing battle. So he decided to go inside the auction, and they amazingly just let him in. Once inside the Utah offices of the Federal Bureau of Land Management, DeChristopher joined oil and gas prospectors in the bidding, raising a white laminated card with the number 70 in big black letters. He bid nearly $2 million for drilling rights on a dozen parcels of remote Utah land, but had no money and no intention of paying. Now, they basically pulled the auction to a halt and he was removed. He then went on to raise the money, offered to pay for these parcels of land that he bought, but his offer to pay was rejected. He was put on trial, found guilty last week, and is now facing up to 10 years in prison and fines of $750,000. The sentencing is yet to occur, and once that occurs, I believe that he has the opportunity to appeal the case. But this, the auction was happening under the Bush administration. It was something that they were trying to shoehorn in. This is obviously after they'd lost the election to Obama before the handover. But the charges and his court case have obviously happened under the Obama administration. Now, after the auction was called to a halt, the Obama administration revealed that many of the lands should never have even been put up for sale, as they were too close to national parks, wilderness areas, and archaeological sites. But DeChristopher still went up on trial for disrupting the auction, found guilty. But interestingly enough, and there's a great interview with him on Democracy Now!, I think their episode from Friday last week, which is worth listening to. During the trial, he wasn't even allowed to say in his defense that he had tried to pay for these parcels of land. The judge decided that they weren't allowed to introduce that into evidence because apparently he said it would confuse the jury. So here's a guy, an activist, who went and bid against oil and gas prospectors for these lands, offered to pay, and is looking at spending 10 years in jail as a result. And this is happening in Obama's America, ladies and gentlemen. Staying with America for the moment, last week it was reported that 9 boys collecting firewood to heat their homes in the eastern Afghanistan mountains were killed by NATO helicopter gunners who mistook them for insurgents. When we say they were NATO, they were American gunners. The boys, who were 9 to 15 years old, were attacked in what amounted to one of the war's worst cases of mistaken killings by foreign-led forces. The victims included 2 sets of brothers. A 10th boy survived. The NATO statement, which included an unusual personal apology by the commander of the NATO forces in Afghanistan, General David H. Petraeus, said the boys had been misidentified as the attackers of a NATO base earlier in the day. News of the attack enraged Afghans and led to an anti-American demonstration on Wednesday in the village of Naglam, where the boys were from. The only survivor, Himad, 11, said his mother had told him to go out with other boys to collect firewood because the weather is very cold now. We were almost done collecting the wood when suddenly we saw the helicopters come, said Himad, who, like many Afghans, has only one name. There were two of them. The helicopters lowered over us, scanned us, and we saw a green flash from the helicopters. Then they flew back high up, and in a second round, they hovered over us and started shooting. They fired a rocket which landed on a tree. The tree branches fell over me and shrapnel hit my right hand and my side. The tree, Himad said, saved his life by covering him so that he could not be seen by the helicopters, which he said shot the boys one after another. General Petraeus pledged to investigate the attack and to take disciplinary action if appropriate. It was the third instance in 2 weeks in which the Afghan government has accused NATO of killing civilians. NATO strongly disputes one of the reports, but another, the killing of an Afghan army soldier and his family in Nangarhar province on February 20th, was also described as an accident. The attack on the boys occurred high in the mountains outside Nanglam in the Pek Valley of Kunar province. American troops are preparing to close their bases in the valley in the next several weeks, in part because their presence has vexed the villagers who would prefer to be left alone. The area is poor and the only major road was built to service forward operating base Blessing, according to local residents. Gotta love that name, Base Blessing. So there you go. Another needless death of civilians in Afghanistan by US troops. Kevin Rudd, the Australian Foreign Affairs Minister, at least condemned the attack, said it is unacceptable that these boys were killed. 9 young boys dying is not acceptable, he said. As for the detail of what actually transpired, it's important to await the investigation. The account from the little boy is, of course, horrific, but let's establish all the facts. These deaths are unacceptable, however, he said. I also note that the number of civilian deaths arising from Taliban operations is increasing. It bothers me that Australia continues to support the US-led invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, and that our incumbent government under Julia Gillard continues to think it's a good idea. She's obviously in the US meeting with Obama this week. And, I have little doubt that this trial will be whitewashed, this investigation will be whitewashed like the rest of the investigations, including the one that WikiLeaks provided the video of. Talking about Australia for a second, as those of you that are Aussies will be aware, and it should be of interest to those of you not in Australia, our Prime Minister a couple of weeks ago announced that the government is finally going to introduce a carbon price in Australia, or a carbon tax, as the opposition has been calling it. And there's been, a lot of debate in the corporate-led mainstream media about how badly the Labor government is going to take a beating over the introduction of this. But interestingly, in the most recent news polls, while the government is losing points and the coalition, the major opposition party in Australia, is up a couple of points, the Greens Party, which are the ones that are probably pushing hardest for this carbon-based tax. And they have formed a loose coalition with the Labor Party, which enabled the Labor Party to form government in this country after the election late last year. The Greens Party are actually up somewhere between 2 to 15% since this carbon tax has been announced. So, there's a lot of debate around whether or not Australians want a carbon tax. And rather than looking at the polls for the Labor Party or for the coalition, I think it's interesting to look at the polls for the Greens, which is obviously the major source of driving this stuff forward. Julia Gillard, the Prime Minister, when she was campaigning in the last federal election, said that if the Labor Party was voted into government, they would not introduce a carbon tax. And so she's being called a liar and, she's been called Jew liar by the right-wing media. But of course, it doesn't take much brain power to realize that when you're campaigning in an election, what you mean is if we win government outright and we can actually decide what policies we're going to push through, we will not introduce a carbon tax. So it turned out she couldn't form government outright. She had to form a loose coalition with the Greens and also with a handful of independents in order to be able to get enough seats to form government. And of course, doing those deals, you don't get to put into place the plans that you campaigned on necessarily. You have to go into a process of negotiation. And people say, well, Australia doesn't want this. Well, Australians, at least enough of them, did vote for the Greens and for the independents, a couple of which that are supporting the carbon tax. So, all of the hoo-ha about, well, let's put it to an election and see what the people think, as Tim Blair, one of our right-wing columnists, has been saying for the last week. Too late, Tim. We did that last year. We had an election, and this is the parties that formed government that the people voted for. We've already put it to election. Changing tact slightly, still loosely talking about Australia, but the UK as well. There's been some interesting UFO coverage hit the news over the last couple of weeks, which I've paid attention to. Now, I am not a believer in UFOs. I just don't think there's any scientific evidence for us to believe that these are credible stories. However, in Sydney last week, there were a couple of UFO sightings. It says they emerged from a blazing light in the clouds, descending on a busy Sydney street before zipping off silently into the sunset. Just what or who propelled the strange flying discs across the sky may never be known. But while the Klaus encounter was over in seconds, it was enough to convince mother of two, Fiona Hardigan, that she'd just seen a UFO, and she has the photos to prove it. Miss Hardigan yesterday said she'd just got out of her car on Sunday evening to snap a few sunset photos when the amazing events began. As I was about to take the picture, this black object appeared and then started to move, she said. It started off about 800 metres away, but it came closer to about 400 metres. And then two other little round things appeared from this bright orange light above. I want you to remember that bit, orange light. There was no noise. It was calm and peaceful, but it was very weird. Miss Hardigan then said the main UFO shot off above Governor Macquarie Drive at Chipping Norton, with the smaller UFO zipping away in the opposite direction. I don't know how to explain it. I'm still totally bewildered, she said. Also, in the last week or so, the United Kingdom's Ministry of Defence released a whole bunch of UFO reports or sightings from the UK over the last few years, and I've had a read through them, and there's some interesting stuff. The first thing that's interesting is a lot of them. On average, each month, there's somewhere like 20 to 30 sightings, and some of them come from what would seem to be fairly credible sources. There's a number of police officers, there's a number of Ministry of Defence guards, there's quite a few air traffic control employees. Let me read you some of these, which you might find interesting. These are in January 09. Air traffic control employee saw an orange glowing object with a red light on the right-hand side. Another air traffic control employee in the same month saw a very bright constant red light. Another air traffic control employee in January saw a bright yellow light. It vanished for a few seconds, then reappeared. Let me scroll down this report. A police officer in February 09 saw two orange lights in the sky that hovered over the old hospital site. The lights were not together, but were stationary. They made no noise. They then moved off in a southerly direction. A Ministry of Defence guard said he saw a wide pear drop shaped translucent green light with a small tail of light, moved in a northwesterly direction, made no noise, and vanished after a few seconds. Somebody else reported three orange lights, evenly spaced and moving at the same speed, gradually disappeared after 5 minutes. Another former air traffic controller saw a large black ball with a light underneath, travelling south over Western Edmonds at 3,000 feet at 200 miles an hour. Very specific. There's a couple of reports from pilots in May 09. One pilot saw a shiny black flying cylinder 20 to 30 feet long at about 4,700 feet, which was 200 feet above the pilot's aircraft. Although the pilot sighted the object, air traffic control forwarded details to the UFO desk. It doesn't make much sense, but that's what it says. Another pilot on the same day, 3rd of May 09, said he saw seven orange orbs that suddenly disappeared. They were on a north-south trajectory. Witness contacted Cardiff Air Traffic Control, who had nothing on radar. Somebody else on the same day saw nine bright orange lights moving at slow speed and at 2,000 feet. They made no sound. June 09, another air traffic controller. Bright orange lights, a single light followed by a group of three and then another single light. So a lot of these reports are bright orange lights. Here's an ex-test engineer for Hawker Siddeley in July 09. A bright orange light seen through the tree line. It turned and cleared the tree line. The other side of the object appeared to be a large rectangle shape of fire red slash orange. It was silent. The object slowly climbed in the direction of Gloucester. So what I'm wondering when I hear these stories of particularly the yellow, red, orange lights is whether or not these are meteorites hitting the atmosphere and burning oxygen in front of them. If depending on the angle of trajectory and where you're standing, they could appear to be not moving, or they could appear to change direction when they hit the atmosphere or plummet down somewhere. Just a lot of these reports are talking about silent objects that disappear fairly quickly and have these bright orange lights, which you can imagine if a meteorite hits the atmosphere and is burning oxygen in front of it, that it would appear to be bright orange or yellow. Anyway, I'll have a link in the show notes if you want to go through and read these. Like, I love reading UFO sighting reports. I don't believe in aliens, but some of these things are just fascinating stories that this report, this 2009 report, there's hundreds and hundreds of sightings that the Ministry of Defense have recorded here. Not a lot of detail for each of them, just a couple of lines, but it's fascinating stuff. Moving back to sort of talking about global politics, there's some interesting news that came out recently in the United Kingdom. Mervyn King, who's the governor of the Bank of England, had some interesting comments about the state of capitalism. He said that the people made unemployed and businesses bankrupted during the crisis had every reason to be resentful and voice their protest. He told the Treasury Select Committee that the billions spent bailing out the banks and the need for public spending cuts were the fault of the financial services sector. And this is coming from the governor of the Bank of England. He said, "The price of this financial crisis is being borne by people who absolutely did not cause it. Now is the period when the cost is being paid, and I'm surprised that the degree of public anger has not been greater than it has." King has repeatedly pointed the finger at the city since the crisis erupted in 2007, but this was the first time he blamed bankers for the coalition's spending cuts. Of course, in the United Kingdom, they're trying to cut public spending. It became clear during the hearing that King and his fellow members of the bank's Monetary Policy Committee, which sets interest rates, believe the crisis will have a lasting impact on the economy. Asked when living standards enjoyed before the crisis would return, King said, "The research makes it clear that the impact of these crises lasts for many years. It is not like an ordinary recession where you lose output and get it back quickly. We may not get the lost output back for very many years, if ever." It's very interesting when you start to see, senior bankers, senior elites that are part of the system actually speaking out about the failures of the financial system and the way that it was handled. Umer Haq, who's the director of the Havas Media Lab and author of the New Capitalist Manifesto, had some interesting comments on his blog on the Harvard Business Review site last week. I'll read you some of these. He says, "Consider a curious set of observations. What's standing in the way of democracy might just be politics. Parties, Congress, lobbyists, the whole glad-handling, schmoozeful K Street shebang, which seems to exist mostly to subvert the will of human people and replace it with the wishes of corporate people. The best investment a company can make? Try lobbying. Its returns can exceed 20,000%. What's standing in the way of capitalism might just be yesterday's capitalists, trying at every turn to stifle competition, squelch information, earn an unfair advantage and extract value from people, nature and the future, instead of creating authentic, thick, shared value for them. What's standing in the way of jobs might just be in part unions, Too often inflexible, rigid defenders of zero-sum thinking, hierarchy and seniority, agitating for more instead of working towards better. What's standing in the way of higher quality education just might be schools, whose top-heavy militaristic management prevents dedicated, talented teachers from evoking the best in their students. What's standing in the way of better healthcare might just be HMOs, whose overweening concern with profit means that Americans pay the most among developed nations for healthcare, but have seen the smallest gains in life expectancy, among other measures that matter. What's standing in the way of finance might just be banks, who, not content with blowing up the economy, getting bailed out to the hilt, and poisoning prosperity, are back to paying themselves mega bonuses for doing all the above, instead of allocating resources productively. What's standing in the way of service might just be the dismal, depressing set of practices known as customer service, which we all know is about anything but serving, and a lot more about ensuring the giant evil corp you've made the unfortunate mistake of dealing with can bat away your question, complaint, or problem with a disempowered drone reading from a script on the other end of the phone who's just as miserable and annoyed as you. I could keep going and point out the same baffling fist-meat-head dynamics at work in every nook and cranny of the economy, but I'll stop there. Now, you probably don't agree with all my bullet points, but I'd suggest that even if you were to scratch your head and agree with a handful of them, it might be a tiny hint at a bigger truth. Economists talk of barriers, and here's my hypothesis. The greatest barriers to prosperity might just be yesterday's lumbering institutions. I think there's some really interesting food for thought there. I want to try and get Umair onto the show and talk about that in more detail. Like, everywhere that you look at the moment, it's just ridiculous. There's just so much corruption and greed clogging up government, corporations, unions, banking. You know, there's some interesting stuff in Australia. We have a TV show here on the ABC, runs every Monday night. It's called Q&A. It's a live question and answer show where they have a panel, usually with a couple of politicians and media personalities on it, a live studio audience, and Twitter input. People can ask questions via Twitter. They could submit videos via YouTube, etc. And last night, the CEO of one of our top banks, Gail Kelly from Westpac, was on. And somebody made the point on Twitter that our Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, earns $250,000 a year to run the country, whereas Gail Kelly gets $250,000 a day to run Westpac, run a bank. It's just completely out of whack. Michael Moore gave a speech, I think, in Wisconsin in support of the protests that are happening there at the moment. And he made the point that there are 400 individuals in the United States who have the same net worth as the bottom 50% of the population, 150-odd million people. 400 individuals that have a higher net worth than 150 million people in the US. It's completely out of whack, people. And we need to do something about it, or we're just going to implode. Finally, keep sticking on the whole finance industry issues. Another really interesting thing I read in the last week came out in Market Watch, another industry journal written by Paul Farrell. He says, put Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein in jail for 6 months and all this will stop all over Wall Street in America. A former congressional aide tells Matt Taibbi in his latest Rolling Stone attack, why isn't Wall Street in jail? Financial crooks brought down the world's economy, but the feds are doing more to protect them than to prosecute them. Taibbi's right. Everyone knows Wall Street's run by a bunch of dictators who are doing more damage to democracy and capitalism than North Africa's dictators. But jail the CEOs of Goldman, Citi, Bank of America, or my old firm Morgan Stanley? Too late. Only a revolution will stop Wall Street's self-destructive capitalism, and watching the people revolt against dictators like Mubarak and Gaddafi reminds us of the spirit that sparked America's revolution in 1776. But today we need a 1930s-style revolution. During the savings and loan crisis 2 decades ago, America had a backbone, indicted 3,800 executives and bankers. Today's leaders have no backbone. Besides, jail time won't reform the darkness consuming Wall Street's soul. We're all asleep, in denial about the moral crisis facing America. Yes, we need a new revolution. And he's got four time bombs that he believes will blow up Wall Street. And here's what they are. Number one, the wealth gap. Super rich versus class wars. Death of democracy. The gap. In one generation, America's wealthiest 1% has exploded from 9% to 23% of America's income, while middle-class income has stagnated. Even Warren Buffett admits, there's class warfare all right, but it's my class, the rich class, that's making war, and we're winning. But my rich friends tell the real story of their social disconnect. The rich just don't care. They live in a different world, live by a self-centered code lacking a moral compass. The public welfare is on it only if supported by tax benefits. The wealth gap is widening, and soon something unpredictable will ignite a Wall Street revolution. His second point, Wall Street's doomsday capitalism versus rule by anarchy. A key Supreme Court decision accelerated and codified Wall Street's ability to use billions stolen from taxpayers to lobby Washington and solidify its power, all for its own self-interest, through campaign payola, senators' votes, presidential access, manipulation of regulators, grabbing tax benefits, etc. And it's every man and woman for themselves. Don't believe it? Know this. Democracy is dead, and you're in denial. Wall Street CEOs and Forbes 400 billionaires are either engaged in a secret conspiracy or a classic anarchy, picking apart America, oblivious of the fact that they're setting up the next big revolution. Point three. Pentagon's perpetual war machine versus America's budget time bomb. The mathematics of our $75 trillion Social Security and Medicare deficits often seem insurmountable, but can be recalibrated. However, the war-loving mindset of America's neocons, fueled by China's military actions, the insatiable expansion of our military spending, and a Pentagon prediction that global population growth is putting more and more pressure on the world's scarce resources and will in turn increase global wars and the demand for more war spending, increasing the risk of sudden revolutions everywhere. Point four, global population explosion versus resources, jobs, better lifestyles. As the world population explodes from 7 billion to 10 billion in the next generation, the demand for more jobs and the pressure on scarce resources will increase, while expectations will fall as the ratio of haves to have-nots increases, making the world all-round Wall Street a burning powder keg setting up a revolution. Bottom line, forget jailing Wall Street's dictators. It's naive and too late. We missed that opportunity. But a revolution will do the trick. Give us a second chance to jail the crooks. Until then, remember these four factors are building to a head, merging into a critical mass that will accelerate into a revolution and destroy Wall Street from within. The widening wealth gap, capitalism's new rule by anarchy, the high cost of feeding the Pentagon's costly war machine, and the huge global population explosion. That's all from me in this show. This show, in fact, all of TPN these days is supported 100% by Suave Lifestyle Group. Check us out, suave.com.au. And thanks for listening, folks. We'll see you again soon.